Have you ever, shivered in winter, pulled your blanket really tight, or maybe stepped outside on a scorching summer day and just felt that amazing cool sea breeze and rain? Where does that actually come from? It doesn't just appear, right? Well, these things aren't random. They're all guided by these invisible, really powerful forces shaping our world constantly. Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we're diving deep into your sources on heat transfer in nature and the water cycle. Our mission really is to pull out the most important bits, the key insights from these fundamental processes. Basically, give you a shortcut to understanding the hidden mechanics driving everything from our daily weather to, well, life itself on Earth.
Yeah, get ready for some, I think, genuinely surprising facts and maybe a few of those aha moments. We're going to connect the dots between what you might already sense and these huge invisible systems working all around us, making sure you grasp not just what's happening, but crucially, why it matters. And, without getting totally swamped in details.
Okay, let's unpack this. This incredible invisible engineering that keeps our world running. These forces, heat transfer, the water cycle, they really guide our daily lives. I mean, think about just choosing wool clothes for warmth, or how our homes are designed to keep us comfy. That warmth from a blanket, those sea breezes we mentioned, rain falling, they're immediate everyday examples. They highlight this silent, powerful influence on weather, life, and nature's balance.
And it scales up globally too. It inspires some really smart solutions. Like, consider why Chennai feels so much more humid than Delhi, even when both are hot. Or how people in Ladakh have been storing water for ages using ice stupas, basically building glaciers. These are direct results of how heat and water interact differently in different places. It's brilliant human ingenuity working with nature.
It's really fascinating how long it took humans to sort of figure these things out scientifically. Like heat transfer, the serious study only really kicked off, what, 18th century, with Joseph Black and latent heat. What was so revolutionary about his work?
Well, the truly groundbreaking thing about Black's work was discovering that a substance could soak up or release huge amounts of heat without changing temperature. Think about ice melting. It needs a lot of energy to become water, right? But its temperature stays right at 0 Celsius until it's all melted. This hidden heat, or latent heat, was a massive insight. It helped explain everything from steam engines to how our bodies regulate temperature.
Wow. Okay, so like a whole hidden dimension to heat. And then moving into the 19th century, we got Fourier and Joule.
Exactly. Fourier wasn't just describing heat, he gave us the math. The tools to predict how it flows with incredible precision that really turned it from just an idea into a proper quantitative science. And then James Prescott Joule, his experiments in the 1840s, they fundamentally linked heat to mechanical energy. That formed the bedrock of thermodynamics, a concept so big it changed how we see the universe's energy balance.
That's amazing. From just watching to predicting and then to this universal law of energy. What about the water cycle? How did our understanding evolve there?
Well, our modern grasp of the water cycle also started coming together around the 17th, 18th centuries, but it really leaped forward with 20th century satellite observations, seeing the whole planet at once. Today, both heat transfer and the water cycle are absolutely critical fields. Climate science, weather forecasting, environmental studies, they rely heavily on data from places like NASA, the World Meteorological Organization. They're not just history, they're vital for our future.
Okay, let's get down to the basics of heat transfer itself. This ever-present force making energy move from warmer to cooler spots. It's not just a definition, right? It's the invisible hand shaping everything. Your coffee cooling down, global weather. And this energy transfer happens in three main ways: conduction, convection, and radiation.
First up is conduction. You can sort of picture a line of people passing a bucket. Each person stays put, but the bucket moves down the line. That's pretty much how heat moves in solids. Vibrating particles pass energy directly to their neighbors. So you heat one end of a metal spoon.
And the other end gets hot eventually.
Right, because those vibrations travel along. Metals are especially good at this. They have free electrons that help carry the heat very efficiently.
That makes total sense. So that's why if I touch a hot stove, boom, heat conducts right to my hand instantly. Or why a metal pot handle gets incredibly hot if it's directly over the flame. Which brings us to conductors versus insulators. Good conductors, copper, aluminum, silver, let heat pass quickly. That's why we use them for pots and pans.
Exactly. And insulators like wood, plastic, glass, rubber, they resist heat flow. That's why your pot handles are often made of those materials, so you don't get burned. And a key thing here is that air, especially trapped air, like in wool, is a very poor conductor. It's a great insulator.
Ah, okay. That touches on something I've always kind of wondered. I used to think wool clothes somehow made heat, like they had tiny furnaces inside. Is that a common misconception?
Oh, absolutely. It's a very common one. Wool clothes don't produce heat at all. They're excellent insulators precisely because the fibers trap lots of tiny pockets of air. And that trapped air, being a poor conductor, slows down how fast your body heat escapes. So they keep you warm by preventing heat loss, not by generating heat. And related to that, cold isn't really a thing that moves in. It's just the absence of heat or a lower level of heat energy. Heat always, always flows from warmer things to colder things, always trying to even out.
That's a really clear explanation. Thanks. Okay, so conduction is about direct contact. What about when heat moves through fluids, like air or water, where particles can actually, you know, move around?
Right, that's where convection comes in. This is heat transfer through the actual physical movement of the fluid particles themselves, liquids or gases. When you heat a fluid, it expands, becomes less dense, and it rises. Then, cooler, denser fluid moves in underneath to take its place. This sets up a continuous circulation, a convection current. Think about water boiling in a pot. You can see the water circulating. Or how a radiator warms a room by getting the air moving.
It creates a loop then. Interesting. Our sources mentioned Ravi seeing wind blowing from the sea during the day. Is that convection?
It is. That's a perfect large-scale example. During the day, land heats up much faster than the sea, so the air above the warm land gets less dense and starts to rise. This creates lower pressure over the land. Meanwhile, the air over the cooler sea is denser, higher pressure, so it flows inland to replace the rising warm air. That's your sea breeze.
And at night it reverses.
Often, yes. The land cools faster than the sea, so the warmer air is then over the water and the breeze blows offshore.
So it's not just about heating from the bottom like a pot on a stove. That's how I always pictured it.
Well, heating from below is common, yes. But you're right, it's not the only way. Convection can also happen if you cool a fluid from the top. Or even side-to-side heating can cause it. The key ingredient is always a density difference caused by temperature variations. That's what gets the fluid moving.
Okay, and the third way, radiation. This one always seems a bit magical to me. Heat moving without stuff.
It is pretty amazing. Radiation transfers heat via electromagnetic waves, mostly infrared. And crucially, it needs no physical medium, no solid, liquid, or gas. That's how the sun's heat gets to Earth straight through the vacuum of space. Basically, any object with a temperature above absolute zero is emitting radiation. Hotter objects just emit more energy and different wavelengths.
So when you feel the warmth from a bonfire across the yard or from an old-style incandescent light bulb.
That's radiation, exactly. You're feeling those infrared waves hitting your skin. And understanding these three modes, conduction, convection, radiation, is so important for design. Efficient clothing, like trapping air with wool. Thermally insulated homes using materials that trap air or other poor conductors.
Like double-glazed windows or wall insulation.
You're right. To cut down heat loss or gain. And of course, those plastic or wood handles on cookware, stopping the conduction so you don't get burned.
Okay, we've got how heat moves. But this whole energy dance in nature is tied completely to another vital element, water. Water is the engine behind Earth's incredible water cycle, the planet's ultimate recycling program, keeping everything hydrated and alive. This cycle, sometimes called the hydrological cycle, is this continuous nonstop journey water takes. Above, on and below the Earth's surface, it's all driven by the sun's energy and gravity. And it's absolutely fundamental for moving water around, refilling freshwater sources, and even regulating climate.
Yeah, and the first key step directly linked to heat is evaporation. This is where liquid water from oceans, lakes, rivers, even damp soil absorbs enough heat energy, mostly from the sun, and changes into water vapor, which is a gas. An important point is that evaporation can happen at any temperature. It's not like boiling, which needs a specific point. Things like higher temperature, lower humidity, more wind, and a bigger surface area all speed it up. You see this when wet clothes dry faster in the front and wind.
Right, so sweating on a hot day is basically my body using evaporative cooling. Turning liquid sweat into vapor cools me down. Nature's AC. And speaking of nature's work, what about plants? How do they fit into this?
Ah, that's transpiration. Plants release water vapor into the air through tiny pores, usually on the underside of leaves, called stomata. It's a biological process, also powered by the sun, and it adds a huge amount of moisture to the atmosphere. The sources mentioned dense rainforests, like the Amazon, can release something like 20 billion tons of water daily this way. It really influences local and even global rainfall. It's like a massive, invisible water pump run by plants.
Whoa, 20 billion tons. Okay, so all this water vapor rises, then it cools down, and we get condensation, right?
Exactly. As water vapor rises into cooler parts of the atmosphere, it changes back into tiny droplets of liquid water or even ice crystals. This usually happens when warm, moist air rises and expands, cooling as it goes. These tiny droplets often need something to form on microscopic bits of dust or salt in the air. We call these condensation nuclei. They act like little platforms. And as droplets cluster together, they form clouds or fog near the ground or dew on surfaces.
Like seeing dew on the grass on a cool morning. That's condensation right there.
Precisely.
Now, I've definitely heard people say clouds are made of steam or just water vapor. That's not quite right, is it?
That's a common mix-up, yeah. Water vapor itself is invisible. It's a gas. Clouds are visible because they're made of those tiny liquid water droplets or tiny ice crystals that have formed from the condensed vapor. It's the physical change back to liquid or solid that lets us see them suspended up there.
Got it. Visible because they're liquid or ice, not gas. Okay, so next, those droplets or crystals in the clouds get bigger, heavier.
Until they become too heavy to stay suspended. Then gravity takes over and they fall to Earth as precipitation. This can be rain, snow, sleet, or hail, depending on the atmospheric conditions. And precipitation is obviously crucial. It's what refills our lakes, rivers, and groundwater.
Right. And once it hits the ground, some of it collects in lakes and rivers. Some flows over the land as runoff.
Correct. Runoff flows over the surface, eventually collecting in streams, rivers, lakes, oceans. It also moves nutrients and sediment around, and over time it shapes the landscape through erosion. Think of rivers carving canyons. Dams are our way of managing runoff, storing water for various uses.
And then there's the water that doesn't run off but soaks into the ground. That's infiltration leading to groundwater. I used to picture groundwater as underground rivers or lakes. Is that accurate?
That's another common misconception. While there are some underground rivers and caves, most groundwater isn't like that. It's stored in the tiny spaces between particles of soil, sand, and gravel, or within cracks in rocks. Think of it more like water held in a giant sponge. These water-holding layers are called aquifers. And that's what wells and boreholes tap into these saturated zones beneath the surface.
It's genuinely mind-boggling to think, as the source mentions, that at any single moment, there's about 12,900 cubic kilometers of water just floating around invisibly in the atmosphere as vapor. That's like, what, 5 billion Olympic swimming pools?
It really puts the scale of the whole thing into perspective, doesn't it? And this maybe brings us to a key point about the cycle itself. It's not really linear. It doesn't have a strict beginning or end.
Right. It's not like step one, step two, step three, in perfect order only.
Exactly. Water can jump between stages. It evaporates from a river, condenses into a cloud, precipitates as rain, maybe infiltrates, maybe runs off, maybe evaporates again right away. It's a continuous loop. And also, not all rain becomes one-off. A lot infiltrates. Some is taken up by plants. Some evaporates before it even hits the ground sometimes. It's complex.
But this constant cycling is what powers so much of our lives. Drying clothes, getting fresh water from a well. Without this natural recycling, fresh water would be scarce pretty quickly. It affects ecosystems, farming, everything.
Absolutely critical.
Okay, let's tie these ideas together with a couple of real-world scenarios from the sources. Show how heat transfer and the water cycle work hand in hand. First, the disappearing puddle. Remember Rohan's observation, a puddle on the playground after morning rain, gone by lunchtime on a sunny day.
Yep, classic evaporation. The puddle vanished because the liquid water turned into water vapor. And the energy for that transformation came primarily from the sun's radiation heating the water and the ground.
And Rohan noticed something interesting. The asphalt around the puddle felt really warm. But the puddle itself, while shrinking, didn't feel scorching hot. Why the difference?
That's a fantastic observation. It perfectly illustrates latent heat. As water evaporates, it absorbs a significant amount of heat energy from its surroundings, including the puddle water itself and the asphalt beneath it. This absorption process actually has a cooling effect on the water. That's why the puddle felt cooler than the surrounding hot asphalt, even while the sun was beating down.
So the energy was going into changing the state, not just raising the temperature.
Precisely. If it had been cloudy or less windy, that puddle would have stuck around much longer. Less energy for evaporation and less wind to carry the vapor away.
And the water itself just went up into the air as vapor, joining the water cycle.
Exactly. Ready for the next step in its journey.
Okay, second mystery, the mountain cloud mystery. Sarah lives in a valley, sees clouds forming over the mountain peaks during the day, even when the valley's sunny and dry. what's happening there.
This is a great example of interconnectedness. During the day, the sun's radiation heats the mountain slopes more effectively, or at least differently, than the valley floor. This differential heating means the air above the slopes gets warmer and less dense than the air at the same altitude out over the valley. So that warmer, less dense air starts to rise up the mountain slopes. That's convection in action.
Okay, so warm, moist air is rising up the mountain. What happens as it gets higher? Does it just keep going?
As it rises, it expands and cools. Higher altitude means lower pressure and temperature, and cooler air can't hold as much water vapor as warm air. So as it cools, the water vapor starts to condense back into tiny liquid water droplets or ice crystals, forming those clouds we see capping the mountains. And interestingly, when condensation happens, it actually releases that stored latent heat back into the atmosphere, slightly warming the air around the forming cloud.
That's fascinating. So why does it often rain or snow on the mountain from these clouds while the valley stays dry? And would wind, say, blowing from the valley up the mountain change things?
Well, the rain happens on the mountain because that's where the conditions for condensation and precipitation, the cooling uplift, are being met. The air in the valley might not be rising or cooling enough. And yes, wind could definitely play a role. A strong wind blowing moist air from the valley towards the mountain would basically push more fuel, more water vapor up the slopes. That could lead to thicker clouds, maybe more intense precipitation on the mountain itself. It really shows how heat transfer, driving the convection, and the water cycle, evaporation, condensation, precipitation, work together to create very specific local weather patterns.
Right. So bringing it all back, what's the big takeaway here? We've dived into heat transfer, the water cycle, and it seems clear they aren't just, you know, chapters in a science book. They're active dynamic forces shaping literally everything in our natural world, from a tiny dewdrop to huge global climate systems.
That's exactly it. Understanding these processes even basically helps you appreciate the Earth's really delicate balance. And it empowers you, perhaps, to make better choices. Understanding insulation for energy-efficient homes, or why certain plants grow better in humid areas versus dry ones. This knowledge is practical. It's happening all around us all the time.
So maybe next time you feel that cool sea breeze on a hot day, or you just watch a cloud drifting overhead, take a second to think about that invisible dance of energy and water that's constantly going on. And maybe ask yourself, what other everyday things can you now explain using these ideas of heat transfer and the water cycle?